Welcome to the 100th episode of the Nicholas Natalie Show, where we chat with entrepreneurs, experts, and entertainers to help you live a more fulfilling life and take your business to the next level. This week on the podcast, we have Dr. Mark Singer. Mark Singer is a ear, nose, and throat doctor of 40 years who is best known for inventing, with speech pathologist Eric Blom, a type of voice prosthesis that allows victims of laryngeal cancer to talk. Amazing. If you're not connected with me on Instagram at Nicholas Natalie, please do so. I'm posting valuable content on there daily. Riddle of the week, why did the jelly roll? Stay tuned to the end of the episode to find out. This episode was mixed and mastered by the one, the only, the Grant Singer. If you'd like Grant to audio engineer your podcast or music, click the link to singerville.com in the show notes or reach out to him on Instagram at Grant E. Singer. That was the intro. Now here is the 100th episode. Hello and welcome. This is the Nicholas Natalie Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Natalie. Today we have a very special guest, Dr. Singer. Dr. Singer, season's greetings.
Thank you. Good being here.
I'm happy to have you here. And here's where I want to start. You are a very accomplished man. One of my favorite accomplishments of yours is your son, Grant. Grant is probably one of the most honest, trustworthy, funny, intelligent, skillful, and talented guys I know. So I wanted to say, I'm grateful that you created him so many years ago. That's where I'd like to start.
Well, you're welcome.
Appreciate it. Now we'll move on to another accomplishment, which I feel like is one of the more unique ones. And it's you did not hit Colonel Sanders with your car. You had a close call with Colonel Sanders, not an impersonator, the real Colonel Sanders. Please tell me more about this situation.
I was in L.A. giving my first academic paper before a large organization of otolaryngologists. While backing up the rental car, a large vehicle, the valet started pounding on the trunk, and I stopped it once, and I looked through the mirror as he yelled, "You almost ran over Colonel Sanders." And there, in a white suit and a string black tie, was Colonel Sanders, the real Colonel Sanders. Yeah. The incident's particularly interesting because some years later, after the successful acceptance of our project and restoration of the human voice, one of our best and earliest patients came from Northern Kentucky, and he was so grateful that he nominated me as a Kentucky colonel with the governor of the state of Kentucky. And to this day, I am a Kentucky colonel, but I have not utilized the privileges, which is a special box at the Kentucky Derby annual race.
Wow. How does it feel to be a colonel? I imagine not many hold that title. Or maybe, is that a popular thing in Kentucky?
Well, it's popular, but it's not just everybody.
Nice. Well, maybe I'll stick with Colonel Singer for the remainder of the podcast then. Here's my next question and where I kind of want to move toward. From what I know is you've always desired to be a doctor, and so much so that you push yourself to graduate early so you can hop right into med school. And I'm curious about, was your experience in med school, I mean, albeit you probably had to have grit and endurance to get through it, did you love it just as much, even though it was difficult?
Medical school is a very challenging time. There's a great deal of stress about failure. And in order to blow off steam, there are also some hijinks that go on. And one of the earliest example in the freshman year, after completing a grueling year of gross anatomy over the cadaver in the laboratory. But as spring came on, the year had passed, no one had flunked out, and a few characters in the class wanted to see how long the small intestine really was. Uh-huh. And it's somewhere between 20 and 22 feet. So they took it out of the body, stretched it out across the classroom, and they were so excited that it was 22 feet that they started using it as a jump rope.
That's incredible.
There was a very well-known story for the West Side Medical Schools in New York, where we were. Legend has it, the students took a human hand with wrist that was left over in the anatomy lab and headed for the George Washington Bridge. As they approached the toll taker, they put money in the hand and then gave the toll taker the entire hand.
I mean, I have to hand it to him. That is a pretty good one. Now, what would you say is something that the general public doesn't know about medical school?
I think the public sees medical schools on television, and they do get a view of the stress side. But one of the problems that's really inherent to medicine and medical school education is that there is a hierarchy, and it's very hard for a person that is creative, that has ideas, to present them when it's a very strict hierarchy. And it's really designed to protect patients. And it's unusual for some young person to come up and say, you know, I've got a better idea.
When you finished with med school, did you feel like you still held on to your creativity going into the medical space? Or were you completely suppressed at that point?
It took a number of years for that to reemerge.
Ah, got it. And it seems like it reemerged because you have an invention. One of your specialties being you treat patients with throat cancer and from whatever it may be. And one of the devices you created is for patients after laryngectomy surgery, and it allows them to be able to speak again. So let's start with the surgery itself. When do patients receive this type of surgery, and what's the result of it?
So prior to the 90s, patients would undergo what's called laryngectomy surgery for cancer of the vocal cords. And most of these cancers are the result of either tobacco abuse or alcohol abuse. The laryngectomy itself, when it occurs, creates a permanent opening in the neck into the trachea or the windpipe and eliminates the ability to produce speech. And when you think about that, speech is such an important human characteristic and quality. To lose it is devastating.
Yeah, that puts people in a pretty difficult spot. I mean, thankful to be alive, of course, but I imagine a difficult thing to have to live with day by day. Now, what was the process like in creating the Blomsinger voice prosthesis device? How did you come up with the solution to this problem?
So we were able to develop a device that allowed air to leave the windpipe and once again go into the throat. And when that happened, the airstream during breathing out would make the tissues vibrate, and this would allow for a frequency range which was much more natural than these external devices.
Wow.
The problem to overcome, though, was to make sure that this passage was closed during swallowing, which is what the larynx does. The larynx is like a check valve. So working with a speech pathologist, Dr. Blom, who enjoyed working on his own cars as well, we developed a one-way valve that looked a lot like the bill of a duck. It would open under pressure and close with elastic recoil, and that became the first voice prosthesis. This was introduced into the patient, it was placed in the patient by a simple procedure known as endoscopy, and allowed now thousands of patients to achieve a natural voice using a relatively inexpensive, removable and replaceable valve called a prosthesis. Early on in the application of the device, and we're talking about just two or three patients, we could see that this was effective and that there was almost no evidence or risk of complications. And the reason for this, it was extremely simple in terms of the surgical procedure, and the device itself was simple. I used to use an analogy. It was a lot like a Polaroid camera, which in those days would have steps on the camera itself. Step one, step two, step three. And then out came a really nice color photo. So I used to explain this to the patients, that this was a one, two, three step thing. It was simple, could be easily understood, and this simplicity throughout the work that I've done has been very important, because people tend to make things more complicated and difficult for others to understand and patients to understand. This whole rehabilitation procedure for patients was very quickly accepted, not only in this country, but also around the world, because there was so little that could go wrong. So I really feel that simplicity is a critical issue in communication, treatment of patients, and trying to achieve success. With the second or third patient, we brought him to the radiation oncology clinic, and we had the patient speak to them. And they were confused because they couldn't understand how this was working when there was almost nothing visible attached to the patient. And a similar occurrence came once when I was at a distinguished American clinic. And just before I gave the presentation, the chairman of the department stood up and said, "This is really ingenious. It wasn't the valve that was doing anything to produce voice. The voice was being produced by the patient themselves, and that's why it's so well accepted. It's their voice. It's not a machine voice."
That's incredible. I want to switch gears into an actual case study of yours, maybe it's called. And a word on the street is you were able to turn an intestine lining into an esophagus. Can you tell me what the circumstances were for that particular event?
Sure. Now, this isn't something that I developed, but we did popularize it both in the Midwest and now here in the Bay Area. Cancers or injuries to the upper esophagus, that would be that area spanning the lower neck and upper chest, extremely difficult to repair so that the patient can swallow. Again, these patients are committed sometimes to a feeding tube as well. So in collaboration with plastic surgeons known as microvascular surgeons, a segment of the small intestine can be taken as a donor and attached in the neck and revascularized by arteries in the neck. So it's not like a skin graft. It's actually, we call a flap, and the rate of success is actually very high, and the patients can then swallow without artificial assistance. And these patients, if need be, can also use the voicing device.
One of the things I am very curious about is surgeries, and my only correlation to Alec and related to my life is it's almost like a game day for athletes. I imagine there's, you know, you go through a specific process to get your head in the right mindset and, you know, be ready to take on everything that goes on inside of a surgery. What is your process for getting in the zone on surgery day?
So I think that's a pretty fair analogy. The process really begins with meeting the patient. So there's an outpatient visit. A diagnosis is either made by you or someone else. And then you begin the problem solving. Usually the night before, you don't sleep very well. You spend a little time reviewing the anatomy, reviewing the procedure, and then the game day comes and you really have a problem, because then you have a patient and family who are very anxious, and anxiety is contagious.
Yes.
And then something comes up like, oh, the anesthesiologist is late, mm-hmm. or they can't find a piece of equipment. So there's all these external noises that go on, and it's really important. The best surgeons are focused and don't let that bother them at all. However, if you look at a TV show, the surgeons can be pretty vicious and beat up on the younger people, and that is a real thing that used to happen a lot in the past as a tension reliever. Today, it doesn't happen because people are a little more correct in their behavior.
Hello, friends. This is Nicholas Natale, and each week I try to bring you absolute bangers of episodes. If you enjoy them, please leave a review on Apple Podcasts, then send this episode to two of your friends that you think would enjoy it. Lest we forget, this episode was professionally mixed and mastered by Grant Singer. If you'd like Grant to audio engineer your music or podcast, reach out to him on Instagram at Grant E. Singer, or you could reach out to him through singerville.com. All right, back to the episode. How do you, one, go about ensuring that you don't get the anxiousness, you don't get it, the contagious anxiousness, and then two, how do you block out external noises so you can lock in on doing what you need to do?
It's actually an ongoing battle, sometimes with the patients. Try to relax them with a little humor sometimes will help. In the operating room, when things are bad, the more yelling, the worse it is. So I don't yell in the operating room. It's best just to control yourself and be calm, because it just makes for more problems. I've worn out some of my molars grinding my teeth, for example.
So that's probably the key of it then, is to remain calm. And something that I really like that you mentioned is the visualization the night before, because I think there's a real effect to when we visualize things and work through things in our head. There's a correlation to how well we perform the next day on whatever that thing is. So that's pretty cool that you do that.
I think so. In training younger people, though, and there are certain people who cannot do it, and they are best not going into surgery.
Yeah, I imagine it's very visual.
But it's very hard to stop them either, because, well, I've always wanted to be a surgeon as well. You need to visualize things better.
Yeah, you got to be able to solve the problem in your head before you solve the problem with the person in front of you. Let's talk about skin cancer, because I know you are on the forefront of skin cancer research. And from what I know, it's one of the most aggressive cancers there is. What would you say has been the most fascinating discovery that you've uncovered during your research so far with skin cancer?
A real milestone in the treatment of cancer has occurred over the last 15 to 20 years. A research scientist at the University of California in Berkeley theorized and developed a medication which eventually became known as immunotherapy. It turns out malignant diseases, cancers, are able to block the effects of the human immune system. If the blockade can be removed, the immune system will kill off the cancer cells, like an internal chemotherapy. So removing the blockade, which is known as checkpoint inhibition, one of the greatest advances has occurred, which has allowed for the treatment of previously near-fatal diseases like melanoma and lung cancer.
Wow.
Former President Jimmy Carter was diagnosed about 5 years ago with melanoma that had gone to the brain. And he received this type of treatment, which was to release the inhibition that the cancer was causing against his immune system. As it is well known, he just celebrated his 70th wedding anniversary and continues to be alive and well with no evidence of recurrent disease. So he is the most notable example of this great achievement.
Man, what does that mean for the everyday Joe like us? How can we, is it possible to prevent getting to a point like that? Do things like sunscreen work for the average person out there to help prevent skin cancer?
They help. Let's put it that way. Education helps in terms of avoiding things like tanning beds. But the message really is, in the event you do have the misfortune of one of these diseases, there is a treatment that is effective.
That is encouraging, for sure. Let's talk about the medical industry a little bit. What do you think has been the biggest change in the medical industry since you first became a doctor?
So a lot of the systems, well, let's start with the hospital. If you're a patient in the hospital, you're assigned a hospitalist who works 8 hours and is gone. Yeah. And may not even come back the next day. Another one comes. So the continuity of care that used to be with your own doctor, that's gone.
Yeah.
On the other hand, there is someone in the hospital during the night, which there didn't used to be. So that's an improvement.
Yeah.
In the old days, when a doctor came into the hospital with a little black bag and sat on the end of your bed and talked to you about your family, that is gone. It will come back? Probably not. There isn't time for it, and that's the bad thing.
Yeah, that's a good point about the time, too. Almost every medical environment that I feel like I'm either in as a patient or in observing, it feels rushed or busy, or, you know, it's like, hey, what's up? What do you need? Okay. And I think you're right. That does change the quality of the care, because it's a person. Let's talk about the current climate of the world then. This has to be discussed. What is your stance on our next best moves in regards to COVID?
The most effective way of dealing with COVID is vaccination. So I would say the most important thing is to accept the fact that this virus is present in our world and in our communities. Over 500,000 Americans died from this disease, But the vaccine has now prevented this type of mortality.
Yeah, COVID has, without a doubt, made its presence known over the past year and a half. And I am thankful that it appears as though our nation is starting to feel hopeful once again, as we were prior to the pandemic. Switching gears here a little bit, what has been the most fulfilling part of your career thus far?
I think the thrill is that you actually help somebody, that thinking through what their problem is, then identifying the problem, and then applying a solution that works is the real thrill. And I remember the first patient that I saw that was in a coma for weeks started to awaken after there was a correction of several abnormalities that the students and residents had worked on. And by the afternoon of the third week, this patient was now awake and starting to communicate with us. And that was an overwhelming success story. Identifying the cause of a problem and a solution, especially as time has gone on and others have failed, is a tremendous achievement and reward for the doctor as well as the patient.
Yeah, I imagine that's probably very fulfilling. It changes the course of somebody's life completely in the best way. So that's incredible. So I think some people, they end up working a job their whole life, and I think other people are willing to chase the things that they're passionate about and find their calling. From what I know about you, you are someone that has found the thing they're passionate about and has been able to do it. Dr. Singer, we are coming to the final question of this podcast. But before I do that, I'd like to acknowledge you for, one, a wonderful career of putting patients first and people first. I think that's such an amazing thing. And I think the grit and endurance you displayed in order to, one, become a doctor, and then two, persist in such a, you know, competitive and, you know, ever-changing field in order to provide better care for people is really admirable. So I wanted to acknowledge you for that before we get to the final question.
Well, thank you, Nick. It's been fun talking to you.
The final question of the podcast is, over your extensive career, I believe it's near 40-year career as a doctor, what has been the life lesson that you hold on to the most?
There's an old anecdote, once again, about medical school, medical students, and young doctors. The story goes that there was an elderly woman in the hospital for a week. It wasn't clear for a while what was wrong. And eventually a treatment plan was formulated, but she declined. And the senior people and the intermediate people came to her and said, "Why don't you accept this treatment? We've worked. We have found out what's wrong with you, and you'll recover. And she said, "Well, I would like Dr. Smith's opinion also. I'm just not willing to accept what you've told me." And they looked around and said, "Dr. Smith? Who's Dr. Smith?" So a third-year medical student in the back of the room raised his hand. He says, "My name is Smith." And then the old lady said, "Dr. Smith, do you think this is a good treatment for me?" Dr. Smith was this small, curly-haired, glasses-wearing kid who had taken the time to listen to her, sitting on the end of the bed, listening to what she had to say about her family as well as her symptoms. And she trusted him. And he stood there in front of all these senior people and said, "I do. Of course I do. And she accepted the treatment. And I think the bottom line of that story is that everybody can make a contribution. It's not all based on that only the professor is right. It's important to listen to everyone, because everybody has something to offer. Even the patient has something to offer. So I think that's an important life's lesson.
I love it. Dr. Singer, thank you for coming on the show. I really appreciate it, and I appreciate your time and insight on everything that we covered today.
It was a pleasure, Nick. I wish you well.
That was the episode. You just listened to it. Uploads every Friday at 6 a.m. The real reason you're still here. You want to know the answer to the riddle of the week? Why did the jelly roll? It saw the apple turnover. Oh man, that reminds me of Thanksgiving. Right, just enjoying those jelly rolls and my apples turning over. Don't forget to leave a 5-star review and to share this episode with your friends and say something nice to them. These are your friends. This is your family. You love them. Say that to them. And on top of that, I love you. I'll see you next week.